Hello, my name is Mark Frantrum. I'm a researcher here at the International Inequality Institute. It's my pleasure to introduce today's seminar. Before I do, I just want to highlight a couple of things we've got upcoming. So tomorrow in this room at 12:15, we've got a video, excuse my Italian pronunciation now, I think this is Chat Semo. Here we are, Lives on Hold in Lampedusa, which is a short film screening and discussion under our seminar series on migration, ethnicity and race. On Monday next week, the 11th of February, we have a public event, Engines of Privilege, Britain's Private School Problem, where Francis Green and David Kinnison will present their new book that examines the British private school system and the inequalities it entrenches. And we've got Luna Glucksberg, who will be discussing their book as well. And then Thursday next week, we've got another public event, which is called Refugee, Solving the Problem of Mass Displacement, where Robin Cohen will examine the limits and possibilities of creating an imaginative answer to mass displacement. So that's what's upcoming. Today, we've got Andy Summers, who's going to talk about the missing billions, measuring top incomes in the UK. So Andy is an assistant professor in the law department at LSE and associate member of the International Inequalities Institute. His teaching and research covers two main areas, private law and tax. He's published several articles on aspects of private law and is currently finishing a book on mitigation and the law of damages. He teaches a master's course, a very well-regarded master's course on taxation of wealth, which he started up in 2017. And is currently working on a related project using tax data on non-domiciled taxpayers using the HMRC Data Lab. Andy's going to talk for 45, 50 minutes, I think. And if it's okay, Andy's got quite a lot of material, so we'll keep questions to the end, if that's okay. So we'll have 45, 50 minutes of Andy talking, and then we've got till about 12:45 for questions, so it should be plenty of time for discussion. And just to let you know, we are doing an audio recording of today's event. Okay, Andy, I'll hand over to you.
Great, so thanks everyone for coming. So my research is looking at what's missing from top incomes in the UK's income statistics. And of course we all know that trends in income inequality have been growing in political prominence across the world recently, over the past decade in particular. But in the UK, the political narrative is somewhat different in that it's dominated by political rhetoric that actually income inequality has not risen since the financial crisis and on some measures has fallen. And in particular, that top income shares have actually decreased since the financial crisis. And indeed, when you look at the official statistics on income inequality, that seems to be borne out. So we have a couple of fact-checking websites here commenting on claims by David Cameron, Theresa May, that income inequality has gone down, saying actually this is what the official statistics in the UK show. And yet, that doesn't seem to be what many people feel impressionistically is the case. So there's a well-known challenge with measuring top incomes in particular, which is that survey data doesn't cover those at the very top very well for various reasons of non-response and under-reporting. And so at least the main official statistical series on income inequality, the one used by Department of Work and Pensions and the HBAY series, now uses has used for some time a top incomes adjustment that replaces the survey data at the top with data from tax records. And indeed the ONS is changing its methodology. There's going to be a release, I think, later this month of a new series also adopting a top incomes adjustment using tax data to try and counter this problem with survey undercoverage at the top. But the difficulty that I want to focus on is that the tax data is collected for tax purposes, which may not be the same purposes that we are interested in when we're looking at trends in inequality as a proxy for economic well-being or living standards, for example. And so my question in particular is, well, what's missing from the income tax data that forms the basis of these top income adjustments that we might want to include in our measure of inequality? So I've got three aims, really. The first is a kind of somewhat technical legal exercise, which is why I hope I'm well placed to do this part at least, which is to map those sources that we might want to include as income but which don't feature in the data derived from income tax returns in particular. And then second, where I would freely admit somewhat less specific expertise, is in an attempt to at least provisionally, indicatively quantify these missing sources. So do they actually matter for top income shares, or are they kind of legal interest but essentially trivial quantitative importance? And I argue that they are important. And then thirdly, we clearly, if you agree that these sources are missing and that we ought to quantify them, have a challenge, which is how do we bring them into our income tax, into our income distribution statistics. And here I want to suggest that a lot of the missing sources, although the data is not currently being used, it is available in various forms for researchers and official statisticians, and actually most of the data that we would need to reconstruct top income shares adding in these missing sources is available, it just hasn't been done. So my provisional findings, and I'll emphasise in a moment that these are very much provisional, is that once you add these missing sources of income to our income series, top income shares in the UK are larger, potentially quite significantly larger, than currently estimated in official statistics. And the reason for that is that the missing sources are so disproportionately concentrated in the top of the distribution, particularly the top 1%, really. And secondly, and in directly engaging with this narrative that I started with, it looks to me like the missing sources have grown relative to observed taxable incomes over the past decade. And so that quite significantly challenges the narrative that top income shares have fallen or stabilised. In fact, I think when you take account of these sources, top income shares may well be seen to have risen since the financial crisis. So some caveats, since this is very much a work in progress, an early work in progress at the moment. I'm conscious here that I'm traversing quite a few different academic disciplines in putting this work together. So the business of measuring top incomes is usually the domain of economists. I'm a lawyer. There are accounting issues here, particularly I'll come on to mention in a moment, the idea of distributional national accounts. And there are deeper conceptual or philosophical issues about what, in principle, you would want to include in your income statistics and not. And so I only really claim expertise in one of those disciplines, but I hope I can contribute to the others. Second thing to say is that in my attempts to quantify the importance of these missing sources, at the moment the aim is just to demonstrate that they are quantitatively important and worth investigating further. And the estimates that I'll show you today are very much towards that end. They are indicative, they're not attempts to rigorously reconstruct top income shares, although I think that that would be a useful exercise. And finally, what I'm focused on really is the definition of income. So the definition of income in the tax data that we use to measure top incomes, and the definition of income that we might conceptually wish to include. That's my focus of interest, but of course there's lots of other issues in the measurement of inequality that I'm not covering here, but that do make an important difference to top income shares. So things like whether you choose the individual or the household as your unit of observation, equalisation between households of different sizes, what summary statistic you use, and I'm focusing on top income shares, but of course the Gini coefficient tends to be weighted more toward the centre of the distribution, and that might give slightly different impression. There's a whole load of issues of measurement at the bottom of the distribution that I'm not talking about, because in those official statistics those are covered by the survey data, not the tax data. And there's a whole host of issues I could go on. I'm not going to talk about those today, but I do acknowledge that those are other issues. Okay, so in the rest of the presentation I want to just give a bit of background about top incomes in the UK, look at some of the statistical series and the data that's used and some of the existing literature on that. Then I want to spend most of the time looking at identifying some of these missing sources. Here, as Martin mentioned, I have rather a lot of material and I'm going to have to skip over some of it, but perhaps we can come back to a few issues and questions if I do move over that quite quickly, and then some implications. So this is data from the World Inequality Database. The data used is the Survey of Personal Incomes, which I'll come back to explain in more detail. That's the main data source used for top incomes in the UK, but here the World Inequality Database uses that SPI tax data to look at the distribution of income across the whole of the distribution. And here, this is just to give you a general impression of trends and magnitudes in top income shares. You can see a rise starting in the 1980s up to about the financial crisis, and I'll mention that a bit more in a moment. Of course, the share depends whether you're looking at before tax or after tax, but the basic picture is the same. If we take the after-tax shares that I'll be focusing on mainly in the rest of the presentation, share of total income for the top 10% in the most recent year available, which is 2014-15, was 35%. For the top 1%, had 10.5%. If we look in a bit more detail at what's happened to the top 1% share since 1980, and these figures are before tax because WID doesn't produce after tax series that includes all of the later years that we have here. Two things that I want to point out, really. The first is what looks like this break in the trend in the rising share of the top 1% around the financial crisis. So whereas income inequality, or at least the top 1% share, appeared to be rising fairly steadily from 1980 onwards, there seems to be this distinctive break point at the financial crisis, and that plays into the narrative that I opened with about how we're all in this together and how top incomes have fallen since the financial crisis. The question is whether that is borne out. Second thing to point out is this sharp, noticeable dip, which coincides exactly with the three tax years in which the temporary higher rate of additional rate of income tax was applied at 50%. So the rate of income tax went up starting in the 2010-11 tax year, although it was pre-announced, lasted for 3 years and then was dropped back down to 45%, and we see a big dip during those years. So what's going on there? Well, we have quite a clear impression of what's going on in the particular case of those 3 years of the 50p rate, HMRC and Treasury and IFS have all done analyses of this. This is from the IFS, showing that what's driving this fall in observed top shares is this process of dividend forestalling. So those who could control the payment of dividends to themselves from owner-managed companies in particular were able, in anticipation of the increase in the top rate of tax, bring forward a lot of their dividend income, which results in a large fall during the years of the 50p rate, and then we see some unwinding of that afterwards going on as well. So that's quite well understood. But what I want to suggest is that that is really the tip of the iceberg, because the dividend forestalling is visible in our income tax statistics because dividends are taxable as income, albeit they're taxed at a lower rate. But everything that is not defined as income for income tax purposes, which I'll come on to, which over this period has also been changing, in some cases is consistently missing, is not visible in our income tax statistics. In our income distribution statistics, sorry. So I'll go on to explain these a bit more in a moment, but broadly speaking, on the left-hand side here, we have things that it's fairly clear we would want to include on any plausible definition of income. On the right, we have some things that are missing, that their inclusion in the income statistics rather depends on the concept of income that you choose, but I'm going to suggest, particularly in the case of capital gains, that it's really untenable not to include these at all. Now, in a sense, what I'm proposing here is not really a new insight, but I think it's been lost. So there's a book by Richard Titmus, 1962, in which he devotes an entire book to pointing out the problems with the income tax statistics that were then being used in the 1950s to measure inequality. And he asks, which is essentially the question that I'm asking, how valid are the concepts and the data in relation to the uses to which they're put? And about a decade later, a young Tony Atkinson is reflecting on Titmus's book, and he remarks that a 240-page catalogue of the deficiencies of the available statistics might have been expected to lead to efforts to correct this problem, but he points out that the failure to provoke a more determined effort on the part of official statisticians and academics may stem from a certain ambivalence on Titmus's part about the role of quantification. And so in this project, I really want to not only map those missing sources, but also try to at least get an initial handle on whether these are important for our top income shares. So, just a bit of background before I get to those missing sources. The UK employs a large range of income statistics series. There's not one official statistical series for income inequality, but probably the most often used and referred to, I'd suggest, is the Department for Work and Pensions series, which is the one that I mentioned earlier with the top incomes adjustment. As I also mentioned, the ONS have their own series, and they are currently adding or proposing to add a top incomes adjustment using tax data to that series. The graph that I showed you earlier is from the World Inequality Database. This was the initiative really prompted by Tony Atkinson and Thomas Piketty and others to use tax data, in particular allowing a long-run series of income distribution that uses tax data for the whole distribution. And there are a few other series that are sometimes referred to as well. But the thing to emphasise here is that with the exception of the ONS series, all of these series use tax data to measure the incomes of the top share. How much is captured in that top share varies from series to series, but tax data tends to be used at the top, as I mentioned earlier, because of these known issues with trying to use surveys to capture those at the top of the distribution. So all of those series using tax data rely on the same data source, which is the Survey of Personal Incomes. And this is produced by HMRC on an annual basis, although there's a gap, rather unfortunate gap. The SPI hasn't been produced for 2008-09 yet, and HMRC are still promising it. Now this is, as I said, the only source of tax data that's currently used in UK income statistics. I'll emphasise later that it's not the only data source that could be used, because we do have access to, for example, the universe of self-assessment taxpayer microdata, potentially. But this data is collected from self-assessment returns and from employers through the POAE system. It involves a stratified sample, and it's cross-sectional, so it's a different sample each year, so you can't follow individual taxpayers over time, which would be useful. The main difficulty that I want to focus on with the use of this data set is something that is highlighted in the methodology to the survey, which is that the SPI provides the most comprehensive and accurate official source of data on personal incomes accessible for income tax. And that's really the crucial issue, which is that what's captured as income in our top incomes series in official statistics only captures those sources that are subject to income tax, and it misses everything else. So I mentioned that at the margins there are some tricky conceptual issues here. Roughly speaking, we can go in kind of expanding breadth here, starting with the SPI definition of income, which is income accessible to income tax, sometimes in other contexts referred to as fiscal income. Somewhat broader than that is the idea of Canberra income, which is used as the benchmark generally for surveys of income. And this captures all receipts, whether monetary in kind, but only where they're received at annual or more frequent intervals, which I'll suggest, that particularly in relation to capital gains, is a choice that excludes quite a large proportion of what we might, for other reasons, want to include in our income statistics. And we can go broader. The broadest is the Hague-Simons comprehensive income definition, and that's essentially just the net accretion to wealth. So this is receipts from all sources and indeed accrued but unrealised capital gains. And as I say, some of the sources that I'll point out as missing do depend on which of these concepts you would prefer to use, but many of them don't. So many of them fits very squarely within the Canberra income definition, but are just missing from the SPI.
And national accounts are above Canberra?
National accounts definitions, I'll come on to that at the end in relation to the Piketty-Sizerman paper on distributional national accounts. In some respects, it can be broader than Canberra income, but in other respects, I think, narrower. So it doesn't map perfectly onto these distinctions. So, thinking particularly in terms of international comparisons, there's a few important features of the UK tax system that become acute when we think about this SPI definition of income as subject to income tax. And the first is that the UK has really quite an unusually narrow income tax base. So there's no legal statutory definition, general definition of income. Income tax is charged only on what is specifically charged under what used to be the various schedules of the income tax. So if something's not specifically charged, then it's not income for income tax purposes. There's no general definition. Unlike many other countries, so for example, the US has a global definition of income, and so do many other countries. The second is that our tax system creates very large incentives to shift taxable income into other sources, because the rates of income tax are higher than those applied to other tax bases, in particular capital gains. And there's also large incentives to shift income to exempt sources, which I'll come on to in a moment. And the third important point is that there's been some very significant changes to those incentives over time, and in particular since 2008. So if we think about changes to the rates and base of capital gains tax, tax rates on dividends, the range of exemptions for savings and investments, the scope to use tax avoidance schemes, all of this landscape has changed quite significantly since 2008, and potentially drives variations in what is then observed in the income subject to income tax. So, in relation to the existing literature, well, there's actually quite a lot being written about this in the US context. So scholars in the US have been quite sensitive for a while to the idea that the tax data that they're using adopts a definition of income that might not be the one that they want to use for income series. So there's a few papers on the effect of the major tax reforms in 1986, in particular on observed incomes. The famous Piketty and Syed paper on long-run distribution of income in the US, published in 2003, that includes in the annex an alternative series that includes capital gains, and others have attempted more recently to take account of accrued capital gains as well as realised capital gains, and then most recently, as I just mentioned, there's this idea in a paper published last year in the QJE by Piketty, Sires and Zuckman about essentially trying to create distributional national accounts by using the national income definition and scaling up what's observed in the tax data and survey data to match that national income total. And in that context, there's been some debate with other authors about the methods that they're using for imputation and scaling, which turn essentially on this question of income definition. And outside the US, there's also been a few papers in different contexts looking at similar sorts of issues about missing sources of income, how these changes in the tax system have affected observed top income shares. But in the UK, this literature is surprisingly absent, apart from that early literature that I mentioned, so the book by Richard Titmuss, which goes through these issues in length, but of course in the context of the position in the 1950s, reviewed by James Merlies and Tony Atkinson, who had comments on this work. But then there's quite a big gap, really, to more recent literature. Tony Atkinson's paper in the Top Incomes SAE collection, he acknowledges there these issues of evasion, avoidance, capital gains, benefits in kind, so he's clearly not ignoring these entirely, but doesn't in that paper or anywhere else attempt to quantify these effects or see what impact they would have on observed top income shares. And there's also recent literature on comparing survey and tax data And that highlights this effect of dividend forestalling that I mentioned, but doesn't say anything about these other missing sources. So what are the missing sources and do they matter? Well, I'm going to go through each of these, and as I said, there's rather a lot to cover here, so I might well have to skip over a few, and perhaps we can come back to them in questions if anyone wants more information. In terms of their order of magnitude, are they important? This just gives us some context on this. So these are the top shares observed using the SPI in the World Inequalities Database series. So shares for the top 10%, 5%, 1%, 0.5% and 0.1%. And these are shares after tax. So if we focus on the top 1%, just to hold in our minds the sort of scale that we're talking about, the top 1% share, as I mentioned, after tax is 10.5% according to the WID series, and that equates to about 97 billion in total income. So you can think that roughly 10 billion is about 1% of the total. So if we start with capital gains, a capital gain is the gain in value of an asset since its acquisition. So we refer to the gain as having been realised when the asset sold. Until then, we talk about accrued capital gains. I'll mention in a moment an issue about whether we would want to include only realised capital gains or also accrued gains. And the issue here, I think, is mainly that perhaps we often hold in our minds a stylized view of what capital gains are, something like the sale of someone's second home, which really doesn't actually capture a lot of what's going on with capital gains. So the point to emphasize here, particularly from a legal perspective, is that the boundary between what's taxed as income and what's taxed as capital gains is extremely thin. And there are various opportunities, and as I mentioned, significant incentives to try to shift your income into what looks like capital gains so that it's taxed at a lower rate. So some of these capital gains will be fairly directly in substitution for labour income. So if we think about private equity managers in particular, private equity managers receive a large proportion of their remuneration in the form of what's called carried interest, which is essentially a share in the profits of the underlying investment. But to all intents and purposes, this is remuneration for investment management services. There's not really any capital at stake, but it is taxed nevertheless as a capital gain, and therefore a very large share of the remuneration of private equity managers is completely missing from income statistics. Think about employee share schemes. So these are options for employees to forego some of their salary in exchange for share options that they can redeem later. When they redeem those options, those are again taxed as capital gains, but it's directly in substitution for salary. I'll mention owner-manager's retained profits a bit more in a moment, but these are profits that are earned by those who control their own company and can choose when to distribute those profits. But if they choose to retain the profits inside the company rather than distribute them, they're not taxed as income until the point that they're distributed, and so again that will eventually potentially show up as capital gains, but will be missed from income statistics. And then, of course, we have, so those are all in substitution for labour income, but capital income ought to be included in our income statistics, and a lot of capital gains are substitution for capital income. So if we think about the strategy of investing for growth instead of income, the consequence of that is that those returns on the investment are going to slip out of our statistics on income distribution. Likewise, to the extent that people have a preference for saving in non-productive assets, so things like famous artwork or prestige goods that don't yield an income but nevertheless they might yield capital growth, upon sale of those assets that will also be missing from our income statistics. So this gives an impression of the composition of capital gains. So as I mentioned, the kind of stylized view of capital gains is sort of sale of someone's second home, for example, but that's really a very small proportion of the total capital gains. And so it's actually only 16% of the total is in the form of residential property. The majority is in financial assets, of which most is unlisted shares. And if we look at the duration of holdings here, we see quite a striking pattern, which is that most assets are actually held only over the short term. So this idea in the Canberra income definition that capital gains are excluded on the basis that they're irregular may not hold true if you're making investments that you realise after a very short time and on a regular basis. You could be selling shares in tranches every year, for example. And this bump at 6 to 7 years, someone may correct me on this, but that looks to me like the private equity cycle, holdings of assets for around that time period. So what's the scale of this issue? Well, remember, hold the thought that the top 1% has around $97 billion in observed income. The total chargeable gains after tax, under capital gains tax, was $43.4 billion in 2016-17. And that excludes gains on main homes. We can talk about whether those ought to be included or not. It also excludes all individuals who have chargeable gains less than £11,000, which might sound like we don't need to be concerned with those people, but if you have a large share portfolio and you realise just some of it every year, keeping yourself just below the annual exempt amount, those people are missing, and so that total doesn't include those people. And if you think about the distribution of these gains, well, 61% of those gains, so $26.6 billion, or a bit over a quarter of the observed total income in our income statistics, went to individuals who realised more than £1 million in gains in a single year. And if we widen that net to those who realised over £100,000 in gains in a single year, that covers 86% of total capital gains.
I return to the question that was raised before. How much of these capital gains are covered in the national accounts? Because some of them obviously are part of what's considered national income.
Yeah.
Some of them are probably not.
Yeah, that's right. So you wouldn't expect the consequences of kind of pure price changes to be reflected at all in the national accounts. What you would find in the national accounts, national income definition, is the capital gains that are attributable to retained profits, because the retained profits would be counted in national income. But I mean, the important point to emphasise is that whether or not this is included in national income, which is a question for that methodology of distribution or national accounts, it's not included at all in our current income statistics. When we're talking about distribution of private income, I mean. And then if we look at the trend here, since 2008, well, if you go back to 2008-09, just very shortly after the financial crisis, and there is a dip here that's slightly, that's probably partly attributable to falls in the market, also partly attributable to the hollowed out effect after some forestalling that went on before some reforms in 2008. But nevertheless, this is roughly representative of the level of capital gains shortly after the financial crisis at $13.1 billion. there's been a 232% increase based on those statistics in capital gains over the past decade. And as I say, all of that is missing. So there are some tricky conceptual issues here if you wanted to include this in your income statistics. I won't go through each of these, but I acknowledge that these are conceptual issues that would have to be addressed. I think the point that I want to emphasise is that it's misleading to ignore these capital gains altogether. And I might just skip over that. We can talk about that in questions, but perhaps the key issue is the thinness of this boundary between the legal definition of income and gains, such that it is somewhat arbitrary to only count or to exclude entirely capital gains from the income series. We can talk about ways of developing this analysis further, but essentially the point here is that using the self-assessment microdata, it would be possible to look at capital gains in much more detail, and particularly to follow individuals over time so that you could actually assess the persistence of capital gains for individuals in the population. Okay, second of all, tax-exempt investments. So there are quite a large series of investments, a growing series of investments, that are exempt from income tax, and so again missing from the SPI. So this includes individual savings accounts, which I'll mention in a moment, of lesser importance, premium bonds and venture capital trusts, and there's various other schemes that I could talk about further. The main point here is that, again, because this income is exempt, it's not income assessable to income tax, and so it's not included in the SPI. So, thinking first about ISAs, people may be relatively familiar with what an ISA is. Individuals can currently invest up to £20,000 per year. So it's not £20,000 total holdings, that's an additional £20,000 each year can be added to your ISA. Once an investment is within the ISA wrapper, then everything accumulated in income and gains remains tax exempt. And so, in particularly in the case of stocks and shares, that becomes significant because you can earn quite high returns and then keep those tax exempt within the ISA wrapper. So, trends since 2008, very substantial increase in the market value of ISA holdings. It was just under $300 billion in 2008, it's now over $600 billion. And over half of that is held in stocks and shares. So, and this is very much, as I say, provisional, it's ballpark, but if we assumed a 1% return on the cash and a 5% return on the stocks and shares, that would be $20 billion. Of missing income. Thinking about the distribution of that income, well, it's true to some extent that ISA holdings are extend further down the distribution than, say, capital gains or other sources. But what's important to bear in mind as well is that what extends furthest down the distribution are those cash ISAs. The stocks and shares ISAs, if you look at the HMRC statistics, tend to be concentrated more in the top of the distribution, and that's where the largest returns are to be had. Now, HMRC does already collect data directly from institutions on ISAs. It's just not included in the SPI because it's not returned on tax returns. But HMRC has this information already. They don't have specific data on income received or gains received in individual accounts, but they do have balances and notes of the asset classes from which you could impute a return based on the general market return. I'll skip over venture capital trusts. Again, the picture is that they've risen substantially since 2008. Non-dom income next. So here we really turn to a focus on the very, very top of the distribution, perhaps the top 0.1%. Quite a lot been said and written about non-doms. A non-dom is someone who's resident in the UK, or those of the population that we're interested in, a resident in the UK, could be living in the UK 365 days a year, but claim that their permanent home is abroad. And this enables non-doms to claim what's called the remittance basis of taxation. And this means that they pay no tax on any foreign source income unless it's remitted to the UK. But it's important to emphasise that in practice, it's overly narrow if we think about foreign income not remitted to the UK. In practice, this, I think, effectively means no tax on capital income at all, because you just hold all of your assets outside the UK. And in fact, there are various techniques that enable individuals to remit and benefit from this income in the UK without it qualifying as a taxable remittance. And again, there's no requirement to report this on the tax return, so this capital income of UK residents is missing. So what's the scale of this issue? Well, there's about 55,000 non-doms on the remittance basis, so that works out at almost precisely 0.1% of the adult population. But that group earns, in total UK source income only, 13 billion, which is an average of about £240,000 each, although that no doubt conceals quite significant variation within that population. But that's only the UK source income, because all the capital income is not reported, or at least all the foreign source income is not reported. And again, could we get a better handle on this? Well, the big obstacle is that not only is the foreign source income not taxed, it's also not necessary to report it to HMRC. There is one way, though, more recently, that HMRC is now receiving data on foreign income of non-DOMs, and that's through the Common Reporting Standard Automatic Exchange of Information, which was introduced recently. That's provided in a format that allows HMRC to match the CRS data to individual tax returns and potentially calculate worldwide income, which is the same basis as is used for all other UK residents. So that is possible. I'll skip over gifts and inheritances. That raises some more conceptual issues potentially, but again, the figure is large, 122 billion, and rising substantially, and unequally distributed. Think about close company retained profits, which I mentioned earlier. That was a feature of the dividend forestalling, but what you observe in the income statistics is only what gets distributed in the form of dividends. Whatever's withheld in the company doesn't appear in the statistics. There's some overlap here, I would acknowledge, with capital gains, because sometimes a realised capital gain is the product of accumulation of retained profits. Gain trend since 2008, 600% increase in owner managers since 2008. That only takes account of, this is a recent analysis by the IFS, very useful, but it only includes single shareholder, single director companies, which is a much smaller population than we would want to include, thinking about all close companies, particularly since there are tax incentives to having your spouse as a partner, as a shareholder, for example, so you can distribute some of the profits to them. And again, similar picture, that the amount of retained profits rises substantially with observed income. There is some work in Norway that's trying to reconstruct top income shares, taking account of accrued retained profits, and as I mentioned, the IFS is doing some work on this as well. Tax avoidance schemes. I think actually quantitatively this is probably somewhat smaller than many people's impressions. The big missing sources are products of tax planning, not what we would call tax avoidance schemes. But an important point to note here in relation to the measurement of top incomes is that the income stays missing from the SPI even if the scheme subsequently fails. And the reason for that is that the SPI data is constructed from the original tax return, which includes the initial attempt to engage in a tax avoidance scheme. If that scheme is subsequently challenged by HMRC, the tax return may be amended, but the amended return won't be included in the SPI. So what we're concerned about here really is not actually the scale of successful tax avoidance schemes, but the scale of attempted tax avoidance schemes for the purpose of measuring top income shares. If I had more time, I'd give you some jazzy examples of Chris Moyles claiming a £1 million deduction for finance costs of a second-hand car dealer business. That one failed, but again, it means that Chris Moyles' income is understated by £1 million in the SPI if he's selected in the sample. As I say, the scale of this is probably not quantitatively as important as some of those other sources that I've mentioned, but it could still be significant in that it's highly concentrated in the top. But the opportunity to engage in tax avoidance schemes tends for the most part to be only possible in particular when your operating self-assessment not really open to people operating PAYE generally. And then finally, tax non-compliance. So here, useful, I think, to distinguish between evasion, which is what we commonly talk about, which is criminal activity and intentionally trying to underpay tax by misreporting, and error, which is not criminal unless proved to be intentional or sometimes reckless, but again, nevertheless, results in income being missing from the income statistics. HMRC do publish estimates of tax non-compliance in their tax gap publication. Of course, inherently it's very difficult to estimate the extent of non-compliance because it's what's not reported to HMRC, but they use a random audit program. They use some matched third-party data, so to try to find out if individuals are failing to declare rental income, for example, using deposit scheme data. And they have a hidden economy survey that tries to capture those who are just missing from HMRC's population of interest entirely. This, I think, is potentially quite significant, and the reason for that is that non-compliance is very substantially larger in relation to self-assessment than it is in relation to employment income. So the rate of non-compliance in employment income, which is covered by PAYE, is trivially small, really, whereas the tax gap for self-assessment is actually quite large. So HMRC estimate this at $8 billion in lost tax. But of course, we need to think in terms of the gross income then that's missing from the income statistics. And so that could be around $20 billion on HMRC's measure. And again, distributionally, to note that this is concentrated at the top. Most self-assessment income is concentrated in those with the highest reported incomes. And then finally, offshore evasion. This is something that Zuckman and others have been looking closely at using leaked data, and they find that the random audit method that, for example, HMRC employs, that understates the rate of evasion in the very, very top of the distribution. It's hard to get a handle on that for the UK, though. Okay, so implications. I said already that I think this indicates, at least provisionally, perhaps I could put it stronger than that, that top income shares are larger than currently estimated in official statistics. Very impressionistically, I have on the slide there the sources that I think are probably most significant for the share of each of the top shares, but as I say, that's very much impressionistic at this point. And also importantly, that top income shares on this understanding have grown since 2008. I think that's quite important in relation to the political narrative that in the UK income inequality stabilised or fallen since the financial crisis. I think when you add back in capital gains, which have increased, tax-exempt investments, which have increased, gifts and inheritances, close company retained profits, if you were to add that back in, you would have a very different picture of top income shares. So what can we do about this? The first thing would be more analysis using tax microdata. As I said, the SPI is a stratified sample, but that's not really its main weakness in this context. The problem is that it only captures what's taxed as income, whereas using the self-assessment microdata, which is available in the data lab, you could look at individuals in data from individuals' entire self-assessment return, which would allow you to get a handle on those capital gains. You could link to other sources about tax-exempt investments, for example. None of this is straightforward, but my point is to say that the data is out there. And secondly, combining with other sources, I'm absolutely not suggesting that we should abandon the current approach of using surveys, especially at the bottom. Surveys capture a lot that tax data doesn't, in particular people below the personal tax threshold, and also benefit, some non-taxable benefit income, but that's captured in the survey data that's currently used. And then other developments going on around this, well, I mentioned at a couple of points distributional national accounts. This is a very interesting new development from Pixie, Sayers and Zuckman, already applied to the US, but proposing to apply this in the UK as well. And the idea here is that rather than starting from what's observed in the tax data, you start from the national income totals, and then you try to scale what you find in the tax data and survey data. You scale it up to match those national income totals, and thereby capture the missing income there. In that sense, what's missing from the tax and survey data that's included in your national income definition. But the point to emphasise here is that I don't think that obviates the need to do the kind of work that I've just suggested, and the reason for that is that how you go about that process of imputation depends very acutely on understanding how the tax system works and what's missing and who it should be attributed to. There's no way of getting around that absence of information. Now let's wrap up by saying, what about wealth? The wealth statistics using tax data are much worse, I think. Yeah, that's it.
Thank you very much to Andy for a fascinating fascinating seminar. Thank you to you all for sitting on your questions until the end. So Andy's covered a lot of material there. I'm sure they must have raised some questions. And I know this is obviously a work in progress that Andy's working on, so we're very interested in any kind of thoughts or comments, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
And maybe even people who might also be interested in working on this area.
Yeah, it feels a bit like a Dragon's Den pitch for collaboration, but
So, anyway, if when you ask a question, you could say who you are and where you're from. That would just help Andy in case he wants to follow up with you later. So, like that.
Steve Schiffer is from City University, Professor of Financial Analysis. Just wondering what you could say a bit more about wealth and how some of your methodology might actually be applied to measuring what particularly probably at the capital gains, not holding of companies, whether that could also help us get around the problem of our difficult in estimating wealth.
Yeah. Sure. Shall I take that now?
So my question is, I think it's a fantastic work to try to quantify what's missing. But the critical question is, so what? And what happens next? And what can be done on that? And I've jotted some ideas, you know, higher marginal tax rates, change in what's definition of income, change in the tax system to eliminate more exemptions. So there's all kinds of tax and policy issues that come up here. But I think quantifying is a really good first step. But what happens next in your research program?
Thanks. I apologize if you said this at the beginning, because I missed it. But I was wondering if you had, you gave some kind of ballpark estimates of the different sources of income loss. I wonder if you could tell us how those compare to the overall personal income, or in particular, what difference that would make, just as a rough estimate to add the top 1% income share, say.
Okay, so on measuring wealth, I mentioned somewhat flippantly at the very end that the wealth data is in a worse state. I mean, part of the reason for not focusing on that is because that's something that a lot of people realise already. But there are two main methods using tax data that have been employed. So the first is the estates multiplier method. So you look at what's in the estates tax data, and then you try and multiply it up to work out an equivalent for the living population. And the second is to work out from investment income. You can then, based on average rates of return, try and capitalize that investment stream to work out the underlying wealth. I think particularly in relation to the investment imputation method, a lot of what I'm identifying is important for that strategy as well. I mean, it's well known that with the investment income method, that you're going to miss all the assets that don't yield a return or a financial return that's taxed, for example, housing. But what I'm suggesting is that there's quite a lot of capital income that's missing besides that. That if you were basing your wealth estimate on the investment income method, you would also be missing by the very same token as what I'm describing. So I think that is important. The so what question. So in immediate terms, I think the so what question is important simply for the role it plays in political narrative about burden sharing of policy reforms that have already happened. So that's why I started with the slide with George Osborne saying that we're all in this together and that inequality has fallen. If it's actually the case that top incomes have gone up, then that paints a very different picture, albeit belatedly. So in terms of the narrative effect, I think it's important, but you're right to pick up on some more kind of specific policy implications. I mean, you could also, I've been kind of grossing everything up to show what the missing underlying income is, but you could also look at pretty much all of what I've presented there in terms of what's missing in potential tax take as a result of exemptions. Because all of these exemptions, the immediate object of interest is trying to work out what's missing from taxable income. But of course, if you're thinking about reforming the tax system, some of these areas might be good places to look. And then, Paul, on order of magnitude, so I've got a lot of slides to get through, but I did start with some impressions here. So top 1% share of observed income in the SPI is just under 100 billion. So that gives you some impression of the order of magnitude. And then I was talking about, for example, so that's 100 billion, over 26 billion in capital gains after tax goes to those who realised over a million in 1 year. So I think we can reasonably assume that most of those are in the top 1%. Even if you were to engage in some process of annualising this amount over, or averaging it over a longer period, you'd think that those individuals would still be in the top 1%. I talked about non-dom income, so UK income was 13 billion. But foreign source income could be larger than that, because that's precisely the incentive for having the non-dom status. And if we think that those individuals are in the top 0.1% probably, observed income's 36 billion, but we could be missing quite a lot more than that. Some others, I think I suggested 20 billion for ISAs. That's going to be spread more broadly across the distribution. But I think some of these are large in themselves, and some, it's when you add them all up, it becomes very important.
Okay,
we've got some more questions. What have we got? John?
Okay.
John Mills from Social Policy. Lots of things to talk about, but we'll do that another time, maybe. But it seems to me if you're going to be talking about things where the shares of the pot may be different, for fairness, it's important that you do think about missing income in the middle at the bottom.
Yeah.
You'll know about the resolution stuff, about the missing survey returns, or benefit income. That's not going to shift the shares a huge amount, but I think we need to allow for that.
Yep.
But the really big thing, seems to me, is owner-occupied housing.
Yep.
I can't remember, $4.5 trillion or whatever.
Yep.
Now, how you measure the return on that coming either as imputed rent or as capital gains measured in some way or another.
Yep.
You know, even if you allow for an overall real return and you were into real return, begs a lot of questions of 3%, you're up to 125 billion, which is going to be upper middle weighted.
Yeah.
Not so important at the top. And I suspect, given how concentrated this stuff is, even allowing for that, you've still got a case. But it does then, I think, also beg some questions about how you allow for inflation.
Yeah.
Because if you're getting nominal capital gains in here, which, unfortunately, you also counting non-dom interest.
Yeah.
So there are a series of things there which I think you do need to set this in context. They may not shift your numbers if these things are so concentrated at the very top, but out of fairness, I'd have thought you need to think of the scale of those.
Sudhir Anand, International Inequalities Institute. That was a fascinating and very impressive work and project. One of the questions which actually follows on from what John was saying, I wonder if you probably didn't, but the Indian budget happened last Friday. And one of the changes, a very interesting change, was that you're allowed multiple home ownership, but on more than one home, you're charged rent, whether or not you rent for rental income for tax purposes.
Yeah.
So you're taxed on imputed rent on your second, third, fourth, etc. homes, however many.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the budget last Friday changed it to not to having the second home exempt, but the third and subsequent homes. That's a regression. However, the point remains that that's a method of imputing value to some asset that you have which provides services, whether you use them or not throughout the year. So you're charged from the income tax point of view, you have to declare the current rental value of your property, and they of course gauge it and assess it, whether it is or it isn't, maybe probably on a random basis, but you are charged tax on that. So that's that, just a comment. I had one little question. You were talking about forestalling dividends, but what about forestalling income itself? I'm not sure if you mentioned that, but forestalling income from an owner-manager, when the 50% rate happened, you could pay yourself more earlier and defer income until later, until presumably at some point, if you expected tax rates to change.
Any other questions for this round? Same problem, Bukowski from CP. I have two questions. One about imputed rents of homeowners. So I think it appeared on your slides, but it was in brackets.
Yeah.
And I was wondering whether you are attempting to estimate them and whether you think they are important for Britain.
Yeah.
And the second question is more technical. So how are you planning to
attribute income which is taxed at the source. And let's say, there was one example you gave, I forgot which one, when the institutions pay
ISAs, I think, maybe?
And then, could be, I don't know.
Yeah,
which.
Okay.
I know it's the same problem as many other countries.
Yeah, okay.
Dividends in Poland. So, yeah. And like, so you don't know who, you know what's the total amount of income, but you don't know to whom actually this income.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Imputed rent. Yeah. Definitely a big missing source if conceptually you decide that you want to include it. Imputed rent is included in the Camber income definition, for example. I put it in brackets on my slides because it's something that I think everyone is already aware of and has a view on whether it ought to be included or not. But I did look up the total for imputed rent, and it's about 170 billion. And as you say, that's going to be distributed a lot further down the distribution than the other sources. So if you were to include those, then it would, I'm guessing, significantly increase, say, the top half share, but possibly actually mitigate some of the increase in the very top shares. And I guess one thing I would say is the fact that we might also want to include imputed rent is not an argument for not also including these other things. I think we want to get it all right and then decide whether we want to include imputed rent or not. I mean, one practical suggestion would be, and that was the reason for lining these up on the left and the right. The ones that are on the left, I think, are incontrovertibly missing on any plausible definition. The ones on the right, you might want to publish series with and without those and see whether it makes a difference. And that's actually what has been done in some other countries. So I mentioned, for example, the Pictet and Saez paper publishes series with and without capital gains. So you could do that for those ones on the right. The other thing, I suppose, is imputed rent, in a way, is actually just the quantitatively most important example of a more general issue about self-dealing. So, I mean, in principle, your allotment where you supply yourself with vegetables ought also to be, it ought to impute an income from that, or your car ownership, whatever. It's just that imputed rent is quantitatively by far and away the most important. In terms of inflation, well, it's true that those capital gains are nominal figures, but to go from 13 billion in 2008 to 43 billion in 2016, given that the rate of inflation was extremely low over that period, I think even in terms of real returns above inflation, that would be a significant increase in capital gains. The point about forestalling, very interesting point, by the way, about imputed rent and that it only extends to the third home. Yeah,
used to extend to the second home until last Friday.
The point about forestalling income. Well, Treasury in 2012 had a report on the effect of the 50p rate, and they looked at what was driving this large increase, forestalling the rate increase, and they found that it was mostly from dividends. There was some effect in terms of other employment income, but if you are an owner manager and you want to do forestalling, you would do it in dividends rather than salary, because then you don't pay national insurance contributions on the amount you forestall. You asked about withholding. So there are lots of complications which Pictet, Saez and Zucman address in their 2018 QJE paper when you want to work out a pre-tax distribution of income. I mean, I have some doubts personally that a pre-tax distribution of income is conceptually possible, because there is no possible world in which you could earn your pre-tax income without the tax-funded state. But that's a kind of deeper conceptual point. But if you want to attribute pre-tax income, then it's true that you have to work out, for example, the incidence of corporation tax on employee remuneration to gross up the pre-tax remuneration of employees. Partly for that reason, I focused on after-tax income, which I think is probably the most meaningful when you're thinking about economic well-being or distribution of living standards. But I accept that it's only that even that's only going to be part of the picture, because it depends on what happens to public spending and other benefits in kind received from the state and so on. But the most of the figures that I've given where it's possible to work them out have been after-tax income. The only other thing I'd say on that is that, of course, all of this missing income is either not taxed at all or it's taxed at a lower rate than income tax. So the effect on after-tax income is actually larger in that respect than the effect on pre-tax incomes.
Regrettably, we have run short of time, but Andy, are you around now if anyone else wants to chat?
Yeah, happy to discuss.